Hi, this is Sid Lieberman, and you're about to listen to 12 Wheels on Mars, a story which resulted from the coolest job I ever had. NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab commissioned me to write and tell the story of the 2004 Mars rover landings. This year, I'm releasing all my recordings for free through my website, sidlieberman.com. Stop by to download tracks, purchase a CD, and find out more about me.
Writer Arthur C. Clarke once said, "Sometimes I think we're alone in the universe, and sometimes I think we're not. Either is a staggering thought." 12 Wheels on Mars. It's January 3rd, 2004, and I'm at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, to witness the evening landing of Spirit, the first of two rovers that NASA has sent to Mars. Hundreds of reporters from around the world have descended upon the facility, and the Mars program manager, Firouz Naderi, says if anyone claims he's calm today, he's a liar. People are feeling a combination of anticipation and anxiety. Anticipation because Spirit is finally ending its 7-month, 300 million mile trip to Mars. Anxiety because more than 2/3 of all the missions that have been sent to Mars have failed. And as if to emphasize that point, Beagle, the European lander, descended to the Martian surface 10 days earlier and hasn't been heard from since. And if these facts aren't enough to cause anxiety, Spirit is about to enter the most dangerous phase of the mission, the last 6 minutes of the 7-month trip. Spirit will enter the Martian atmosphere 6 minutes before it lands, but in that short time, a series of events have to take place or the rover will crash. Officially, the time is called EDL, entry, descent, and landing, but unofficially, the staff has dubbed it the 6 minutes of terror. Spirit will enter that Martian atmosphere going around 12,000 miles per hour, a speed that will take it across the United States in a little over 20 minutes. Hopefully the heat shield's in place, because as it plunges toward the Martian atmosphere, the friction will raise the temperature to 2,600 degrees Fahrenheit outside the craft. As it plunges through that atmosphere, in 4 minutes, that friction will also slow it to 1,000 miles an hour. And then with 2 minutes to go, a parachute will open, slowing it even more. And 20 seconds later, the bottom half, the heat shield, will break off. And 10 seconds later, the lander, the protective case holding the rover, will drop down. And the parachute craft and lander will continue to plummet toward the Martian surface for the next 82 seconds, until 8 seconds before impact, when suddenly airbags will inflate, envelop the lander, and 2 seconds later, with 6 seconds to go before crashing, the retro rockets will fire, stopping the craft 30 to 50 feet above the Martian surface. And then the 1,100 bubble wrap package will drop. If the airbags hold it, it will bounce as high as a 4-story building. And then, looking like an odd beach ball, it will continue to bounce along the Martian surface until finally it'll stop and signal home that it's safe. That's the signal that everyone will be waiting for this evening. On the day of the landing, I talked to Phil Christensen, a scientist who has one of the 5 main scientific instruments aboard the rover. His mood was typical of the people at JPL. On the one hand, he was very confident. He said, "We've tested so much. We've put in such effort. We have so many resources. I would be surprised if we fail." When he talked about his instrument, he spoke with awe. He said, "I used to look at it and think to myself, something I held in my hand, something I built, is going to be on Mars. I would look at that pale red dot and think, it's going to be there. I said goodbye to it before launch." But also, he couldn't help thinking of the 93 Observer mission. The first instrument he ever built was on that mission, and it was lost. He told me he worked for 10 years on that instrument. "My kids grew up," he said. "I missed a lot of it, but I thought, okay, it's for humanity. It's for knowledge. When we heard that mission was doomed, I can't tell you how I felt. It was all for nothing." It was all flushed away. The feeling of what if hung in the air at JPL on the day of the landing. The mission had begun in earnest 3 years earlier when NASA was trying to decide what to do in 2003. And so there they were in 2000. They've had tremendous successes in the Mars program. They put orbiters circling the planet. They've landed vehicles on the planet. They've even landed a small rover, Sojourner, on Mars in 1997. But there's also been discouraging failures, including three in the 1990s, the last, a lander in 1999. So there in 2000, they were trying to decide what to do in 2003, and they had three choices. They could choose to do nothing. They could scrub the idea. Or they could choose to put an orbiter around Mars, or they could choose to do the most difficult thing, which is to put a rover on the planet's surface. I talked to Jim Garvin, lead scientist for the Mars Exploration Program. He said he remembers 3 days of withering discussions. And then when it came time to make the decision, he said everyone looked at me and Dan McLeese as if to say, okay, science guys, okay, nerds. What would you do? And Garvin said, I didn't know I was going to say it till the words were out of my mouth. I said, rover, we have to send a rover. We have a planet, we have questions, we have to get to the surface. Ultimately, the question is whether there was ever life on Mars. But to answer that question, you have to answer another question. For life as we know it, you need water. Now, we know there's no water on Mars now, but we also know there was water in an earlier time. The orbiters have sent us pictures of formations that look like riverbeds and gullies and channels. We've even found hematite on the planet, a mineral that on the Earth is formed in the presence of water. So the question is not whether water was ever there. The question is whether it was there long enough to foster and sustain life. That's what we had to go and find out. Phil Christensen, the scientist who has one of the five instruments on the rover, is also a professor of geological sciences at Arizona State University. And he said to me, the answer is in the rocks. Now, he's a bearded, congenial man who loves to talk about rocks. He said, I can tell you the story of the landscape underneath me by studying the rocks beneath my feet. The rocks and the minerals they contain are going to tell us the story of Mars. They'll be our time machine. They're going to take us back 2-3 billion years. The minerals are just waiting there for us to identify them. I was born in a lake. I was born in a river. I was formed in a volcano. And Garvin was sure that the way to study those rocks was with a rover. Now, Garvin is a small man, filled with enthusiasm and energy. And when he talked about the rover and that mission, his excitement just bubbled over. He said, they'll be our geologists. They're going to be self-sufficient. They're going to roam on Mars with their own instruments and their own power source. We are going to see the Martian surface through the bionic eyes of those wonderful machines. To Garvin, the mission was important because he felt that when they found hematite, it was like a fingerprint. He said, it's as if Mars is saying to us, come here. Come here. You'll understand. And then he smiled at me. He said, but I knew that selling a mission to look at rocks was going to be a hard sell. They're boring chunks that people want to throw out of their backyard. But I also knew that I never knew a rock that lied to me. Well, NASA decided to send two, not one. Of course, they saw one as a backup in case something happened. They felt they could do twice as much science for not twice as much money. But most important, it was a way to look at two different portions of Mars. It was a gutsy decision. Everyone knew that this was the most dangerous thing that they could choose to do, but they also knew that danger and failure go with the territory of exploration. The way Garvin put it, We all know that Magellan sailed around the world, but the sea is littered with ships whose names we don't know. Over the course of construction, they named the rover Spirit and Opportunity. They ran a naming contest. It was won by Sophie Collis, a 9-year-old third grader, who wrote, "I was born in Siberia. I lived in an orphanage. It was cold and dark and lonely. I would look up at the sparkly sky at night and think I could fly there. In America, all of my dreams can come true. Thank you for the spirit and the opportunity." Well, it's one thing to say you're going to build two rovers, and it's another thing to actually do it. The decision was made in August of 2000, and launch was set for June of 2003. For one thing, you can only send a vehicle to Mars every 26 months. The planets have to be properly aligned. And 2003 seemed particularly good because Mars would be closer to the Earth than it had been in 60,000 years. But that gave JPL only 39 months to create two rovers practically from scratch. And they would have to survive the shock of launch, endure 7 months in the vacuum of space, survive the violence of entry, descent, and landing, and then work on a planet for 3 months at least, whose average temperature was 67 degrees below zero. But JPL embraced the task. If this were a play, Act One would be called Design and Development, and it would star the engineers and scientists. There were hundreds of design decisions to make. What would a rover carry? What would it look like? How would it move? I talked to Kobe Boykins, who led a team that designed the solar panels. Boykins is a young African-American male with a bald head and a lot of spirit, and he was happy to tell me how they went about it. Their job was to put enough solar cells on the rover to power all of the activities. Now, the scientists, they wanted to cram as many instruments on as they could. It was up to the engineers to tell them what was possible. The solar cells are small, a half an inch by 2 1/3 inches. And so Boykin said what his team did was they took little pieces of paper and they moved them around, drawing lines between them. We did what you do with Legos. We would try configuration after configuration. And every now and then someone on the team would yell, "I just got another cell." And it was very exciting. The finished product were solar panels containing the cells. They would be folded up during the trip to Mars and unfolded again, creating 4 square feet of energy-producing surface. When they tried the unfolding for the first time, Boykin said they were around the whole team, and suddenly it was ready to go, and nothing happened. He thought, "Oh, my God." And then he said, I heard, and then burr, 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 burr. They were opening, and then click, they locked in place. He said, "I'm thinking, oh, it's working. And then, and the secondary panels locked in place. And he said, I began to shout, it worked. And then he said, I started to cry. I couldn't help it. I'm not married, I don't have children. But this... this must be what childbirth is like. Well, all the teams had to do that. They all had to work. And they worked hard. Boykin said his team put in thousands of hours. He said at the beginning of the project, the guy said to him, "Do you have a girlfriend?" And when he told him no, the guy said, "Well, don't expect to get one." And he said, "My dog was so happy when I would come home, he couldn't believe I was there." And Christensen, he said his team that helped him build his instrument would come in at 7 in the morning and leave at midnight. I'd have to tell him you could only work 80 hours a week. He said they put so much in to the project, so much effort, that when it was over, they suffered from postpartum depression. He said, I said to him, "Guys, you need some psychological help here." And yet the word I kept hearing on the day of the landing was cool. Building a rover was cool. Sending a rover to Mars was cool. And as Jim Erickson put it, what could be more fun? If it works, we get to drive an all-terrain vehicle on another planet. The result of all that work, two identical rovers, standing 4 feet 9 inches high, 7 feet 6 inches wide, and 5 feet 2 inches long. It actually is a bird-like looking rover. From a horizontal deck that in some ways looks like the wings of a bird, a mast rises straight up, making the rover look like an ostrich with a stiff neck. At the top is one of the 5 main scientific instruments, the PanCam, 2 cameras that take 3D pictures of Mars. Eric DeYoung, he said, these cameras are like cameras on steroids. They are so good that the resolution is so wonderful, we will blow those pictures up to movie screen size and we won't lose any details. People will come in and look at those pictures and think they're standing on the surface of Mars. When I saw the replica for the first time here at JPL, to be honest, I was a little disconcerted because it really did look like a head at the top of that mask. And those cameras, they look like eyes. And I was even more disconcerted when I found out that that head could revolve 360 degrees. Right underneath it was Christensen's instrument. Now, it surveys the landscape using 167 bands of infrared light to find intriguing minerals that other instruments could study later. The mast sinks down to the deck, which it's actually the solar panels that were folded up and now are unfolded. There are antennas on top of the deck to communicate, and under it, 6 wheels and other cameras looking for hazards. In the front, an arm. Actually, it looks like a human arm. There are joints at the shoulder and the elbow and the wrist. And at the end of the arm, something that looks like a fist. On that fist is the rock abrasion tool. JPL calls it the RAT. It grinds holes in the rocks. And on the other side are 3 instruments, the other 3 main scientific instruments, a microscopic imager, which produces pictures that the details are finer than a human hair. It's a combination of camera and microscope, and 2 spectrometers that measure a number of things, including the iron content in rocks and the elements that make up the Martian surface. The rover begins its work by getting information from the PanCam and the mini test. The PanCam looks out, surveys the landscape. The mini test looks out, surveys the rocks. When the information comes to Earth, the scientists decide where to send the rover. They create a program, and the rover goes there and then sticks out its arm and puts the fist against the rock. The rock abrasion tool will grind the hole, and then the fist will turn, and the microscopic imager and the 2 spectrometers will do their work. People say, they like to say that the rover rolled to the rock. It's not true. The rover would like move for 10 seconds and stop, look for problems. No one wants an accident. And then it would go on for another 10 seconds. It's actually very lifelike. There's a program on board that even makes it more lifelike. It's designed to protect itself. If on the way to a rock it discovers a problem that the scientists haven't seen, it's programmed to find another way to get there. And if it can't find that way, it's programmed to stop. The way Garvin put it, it's as if the rover is going, this is no good. Let's try this. No. I better stop. Maybe I should call home. The shape of the rover was dictated by the fact that JPL wanted to put it in the size lander that had been used in the Sojourner mission. Now, again, the lander is the protective case that the rover goes in. It was a pyramid-shaped lander, a base and 3 panels. Once the rover was safe on the planet, the lander's panels would open, revealing the rover inside. The way Christensen put it, it was as if they said, here's a box. Put as much in it as you can. Have fun. Well, if you've ever taken a long trip, you know it's not fun. You have to decide what you're going to take. And then when you make that decision, you have to try to get it into the trunk of your car. Well, this mission was no different. This was a long trip. And they wanted to put a lot on those rovers. Finally, the rover turned out to be too big for the lander. And so the engineers had to find ways to fold it up and tuck it in. Project scientist Joy Crisp marveled at what they had done. She said, someone will see the rover rolling around on Mars and think, you know, I can buy a toy like that at the store. They have no idea what went into it. The engineers were brilliant. Even we're awestruck at the complexity of what we created. And those complex machines were created by scientists and engineers that designed, built, and tested everything during those 40 months, for 34 months. And I mean tested everything. To see if the rover would work in Martian temperatures, they put it in a vacuum chamber and dropped the temperature to 140 degrees below zero. To see if the instruments would survive launch, they attached them to shake boards and shook them harder than they would be shaken at launch. They tested the rock abrasion tool to see if it actually could grind at the rocks as hard as those that we found on Mars. They tried to see if the parachutes would rip, if the airbags would hold. They tested and tested and tested and found problem after problem. The pan cam didn't work in Martian temperatures. The mini test wouldn't work if it were tilted in a certain direction. One spectrometer shut off 14 times accidentally during a test. The rock abrasion tool left dust on the rock after the grinding. The parachutes shredded, the airbags broke. And so they went back and they designed again and they rebuilt and they tested and tested. Now scientists used to joke, still joke, that there's a great galactic ghoul protecting Mars because it's so difficult to get there. Well, if that's true, the ghoul was working overtime on this mission. Because even when the rovers got to Florida for Act Two of this drama, launch, there were still problems. Fuses blew. A battery died. They discovered a cable problem that would cause a short and destroy both rovers. Spirit developed a problem with its pyrotechnics, 37 devices that explode and detach things like the parachute. That was only fixed a few days before launch. Opportunity, sitting on its launch pad, had the cork insulation of the Delta rocket that was going to take it into space fall off. It had to be glued back on, and it happened twice. There were storms, there were potential storms, but finally, after a delay of 10 days, on June 10th, the Spirit was ready to take off. Those who were there said it was a stunningly beautiful day, and when the rocket ignited, the launch pad was filled with smoke and fire, and the rocket, it inched up as if it were deciding whether to go or not. And then as if it had made the decision or had just woken, it tore a tunnel through the sky and gracefully curved toward the horizon and then was gone. Nagi Cox, an engineer, was at that launch, and she told me, she said, there's something so powerful, so physical, so overwhelming about a launch. And we're sending something up into space, but it wasn't just a liftoff. I kept thinking, we'll never see it again. We'll never see it with our own eyes. And it's going where we can't go right now. It's the best of us. She told me this was her first launch. And she said, I learned never to wear mascara to launches. About a month later, the scene would be repeated, only this time at night. Opportunity was on its launch pad after a delay of 2 weeks. There were only a few days left in the launch window. But it was ready to go. All systems were to go. The countdown began, and the great galactic ghoul struck one last time. They stopped the countdown with 7 seconds to go. A malfunctioning valve. Now, Stephen Squires, who had created the science package that would be on the rovers and would supervise the scientific activities once they landed on Mars, said he knew it would be difficult getting to Mars. He said, I never knew how hard it would be getting off Earth. But 40 minutes later, Opportunity took off. It joined her sister in space, both rovers. We're now on their 300 million mile 7-month trip to Mars. Mars. It's always fascinated us. To the ancients, it reminded them of evil and blood. It was named after the Roman god of war. But even now, when science has replaced mythology, it's still fascinating. I think partly because it's so close. Only Venus comes closer. And partly because it's so much like us, and yet so different. It's not made of gases. It's made of earth and rock. And yet it's half our size. It has gravity, but only a third of ours. Its atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide. The temperatures on Mars vary, but those temperatures vary from 199 degrees below zero to 80 above. Pictures have shown us a fantastic version of our own landscape. Mount Everest, our highest mountain, rises 5.5 miles. On Mars, there's a volcano that rises 16. It's the highest peak in the solar system. Our Grand Canyon averages 1 mile in depth. On Mars, there's a canyon system that averages 3 to 6 miles in depth. We're blue. It's red. We have life. Did it? Now we were going to find out. Act three of this drama, the trip from Earth to Mars, the staff at JPL called the cruise phase of the mission. Cruise. Such a nice word. Conjures up ocean liners, fast cars, and ease. Let's go on a cruise, dear. I was just cruising down the highway. But this cruise was nothing like that. There was so much to do. The navigators continuously plotted the rover's courses to Mars. Not only were they expected to land the rovers on the planet, but they had to put them at precise points on the planet's surface. Spirit was heading toward the Gusev crater, a depression as large as the state of Connecticut. But the navigators weren't just aiming for the depression. The target area within that crater was 50 miles long and 7 miles wide, and the bullseye was a 4 mile square. The same would be true for Opportunity that was hurtling toward the other side of the planet, toward the Meridiani Plain, where they had found an Oklahoma State deposit of hematite. To do this, one navigator said, it's as if you were standing in L.A. and trying to find a spot in New York City the size of a quarter. So both rovers had 6 moments in the flight where the navigators could change the course. They were called trajectory correction maneuvers. Now, Bob Mays, he explained it by, he said, think of golf. He said, launch is like the shot off the tee. It can slice, it can hook, it can go anywhere. Things aren't stable at launch. But now you're out in space, and you know where your target is, and so you take your second shot, and then you take your third, and pretty soon you're lining up shots on the green. Well, it's an excellent analogy, except in golf, the hole isn't moving. Mars is, at around 54,000 miles an hour, revolving around the sun, and it's rotating on its axis. So consider the task that faced the navigators. They had to guide two vehicles going at about 70,000 miles an hour on a 300 million mile trip, and they hoped to hit a square 4 miles wide on a moving, spinning planet. May said to me, there's a lot of number crunching in navigating, but conceptually it's an art form. If we succeed, it's as if we had guided a car by remote control from L.A. to New York, and not only can we tell you it got there, we can tell you where we parked it and how well we parked it. As the vehicles approached Mars, Louis DiMario, the lead navigator, announced that the navigation for Spirit was essentially perfect. They wouldn't need the last two trajectory correction maneuvers. And the navigation for Opportunity was even better. They wouldn't need three of the six. It would only take three corrections to get that rover to its site. Meanwhile, While the navigators were doing their work, the team that had to operate the rovers once they were on Mars were busy with their tasks. They practiced in what JPL called a sandbox, an indoor facility of rocks and dirt. It looks like the Martian surface, with a replica of the rover that they can put through its paces. It was just a continuation of the work they had done on Earth. For instance, by the time the rover actually rolled off the lander on Mars, they would have practiced that maneuver over 500 times. Some of these tests or practice sessions lasted for days, some for weeks. It gave the team an opportunity to use the equipment, but also gave them an opportunity to get a taste of what it was like to live on Martian time. Because the rovers are solar powered, they take their power from the sun. But it doesn't matter if the sun is shining here. It matters when the sun is shining on Mars. If the rover sleeps through a Martian night and works through a Martian day, so does the mission team. The problem is that the Martian day is 39 and a half minutes longer than an Earth day. So every day the rover would begin work 39 and a half minutes later, and so would the 200 or so scientists and engineers who were helping operate them. Well, you start work at 9 o'clock, and the next day about 9:40, and the next day about 10:20, and pretty soon you've worked away around the clock. It's a snap for the rovers, but it's exhausting for humans. One of the reasons is the cues you get from the outside world, such as sunlight, throws off the body clock of those pretending they're on Martian time. So visiting scientists lived in rented rooms with blackout shades. The control room was blacked out. And the staff that had families here, they lived with a perpetual nightmare of jet lag. They would have to ferry kids to activities or run errands, sometimes not knowing what time it was. Some took to wearing two watches, one with Earth time and one made especially for the project that told Martian time. Now, nobody expected this 7-month trip to happen without a glitch or two. And the rovers faced a doozy: solar flares. Now, solar flares are the most powerful explosion in the solar system. They're an explosion on the sun. The power is equal to 1 billion 1-megaton nuclear devices going off at the same time. Now, Nagin Cox, the engineer who was so moved at launch, was deputy chief in charge of engineering in this phase of the mission. So it was the job of this petite, intense woman to deal with those flares. She said to me, when they happened, I thought to myself, thank you very much. I learned more about the sun in 1.5 months than I ever knew before. It was a system-wide event, and so we had to know what had happened to the other ships in space. Suddenly, the crews were cross-communicating. She said it was like a cartoon. Everybody was talking at once. What happened to you? I'm fine. What's going on? Well, the staff at JPL felt that the software aboard the rovers might have been corrupted, and so they decided to reboot. Now, if you own a computer, you have an inkling of what they were going through. You're sitting at it and you get a signal: fatal error, reboot. Your system becoming unstable, reboot. And when you do, all you can think of is, please let it be okay, especially if you haven't backed up your hard drive. But JPL had a little more riding on their rebooting, and I don't mean the $820 million that the mission cost. It was all the years of effort and work. Cox said, I don't want to be melodramatic, but when we pushed that button to do a cold reboot in space, we had a foretaste of what the 6 minutes of terror would be like. We were stressed by the unknown. We could have done everything perfect, and yet when we turned off that system, it might not have come back on. You can't prepare for the truck that's going to hit you. I heard that sentiment repeated again and again on the day of the landing. Garvin said, we're frail humans, and there's acts of God. And Mark Adler summed it up. He said, we dodge bullets every day, but it only takes one. And so, on January 3rd, 2004, Spirit was nearing Mars, and the JPL staff was getting ready for the 6 minutes of terror. Act 4 of this drama, entry, descent, and landing, began for me about an hour before launch. It's when I joined a group of scientists and engineers in what would look like a large classroom. We sat in chairs around tables set in a U shape, and we were facing a huge television screen that was picturing mission control. I looked around at the men and women in that room, and I thought to myself, the culmination of all their work is about to take place, and ironically, they can't do anything about what's going to happen. JPL was not controlling the vehicle in real time. There was a software aboard the program, aboard the rover, that was now in charge. The reason was, if there was a problem, there wasn't anything anyone could do. It takes 9.5 minutes for a message to reach Earth from Mars. And so, in fact, entry, descent, and landing had already taken place before any signal reached JPL. At this point, everyone was just along for the ride. And so we waited and waited. People talked, they clumped together, they took pictures, teams took group pictures. Three guys with cell phones took pictures of each other taking cell phone pictures. The scene in Mission Control was familiar. Banks of computers, operators sitting there, people in the back milling around and standing. It was about 12 minutes before Spirit was due to enter the Martian atmosphere when she sent a signal that she had detached from the cruise ship, the ship that had propelled it for the last 7 months. That ship would now fall into the Martian atmosphere and burn up. Spirit was on her own. In the control room, they reenacted an old tradition. They began to eat Lucky Peanuts. People settled in. The tension began to rise. No one was more tense than David Lavery, the program project executive. He told me that not only did they test everything to death, they tested to the last minute, and 4 hours before Spirit was due to enter the atmosphere, they found a bug in the software. He said under rare conditions, 4 of the 37 pyrotechnic devices wouldn't go off. The chances of that happening, he said, are practically zero. But if it happened, we'd lose the rover. And yet if we change the software, we might create another problem. It would be trading an unknown for an unknown. But we changed the software. For the next 4 hours, he worried whether they had made the right decision. He said, for those 4 hours, I vibrated between euphoria and terror. And I don't mean move. I mean vibrated. Finally, Spirit signaled that she had entered the Martian atmosphere. The 6 minutes of terror had begun. Now things happened very quickly. A second signal came that the craft was decelerating at the right speed, and then a third that the parachute had opened, and very quickly that the heat shield had broken off, the lander had dropped, and then the retro rockets fired, the airbags deployed at the right time. It was dropped, and everyone was waiting for that signal that it had happened, that it was safe. In fact, people were actually leaning forward as if they could hear better. And then suddenly it was announced, we have a signal, a bouncing signal. A bouncing signal means it's safe, it's on the surface. And everyone began to cheer and shout. And at the top of that, suddenly there was an announcement that we lost it. People were stunned, sat down. No one knew what to say. I talked to Jennifer Trotsberg, who would lead the Spirit mission once it was on the ground. And she said, I didn't know. I thought maybe the signal had come before it was on the planet. Or maybe there had been a catastrophe. Maybe the landscape was more complicated than we thought. Christensen said he thought, that's it. That's it. We lost it. We sat there in silence, or just whispering, as if we were dealing with a dying patient. 2 minutes went by. Nothing. 4 minutes. Nothing. 6 minutes. Nothing. A cell phone rang. Somebody quipped the wrong kind of call, and there was nervous laughter in the room. 8 minutes. Nothing. 10 minutes. At 10 minutes, the rover was expected to signal home that it was safe. And yet at the 10-minute mark, Spirit hadn't signaled or we hadn't found it. The deep space antennas at Goldstone and Canberra searched the night sky for that tiny 40-watt signal. 12 minutes. Nothing. 15 minutes. Nothing. Some were thinking of the Polar Lander, the 1999 mission. It had, too, had been on a perfect trajectory towards Mars. Its entry was described as a gnat's eyelash away from perfect. And yet when it landed, we never heard from it again. To this day, no one knows why. They didn't have to announce it. Suddenly, people in the control room straightened up and began to point. At 17 minutes, they found the signal. Spirit was safe. Pandemonium broke out in that control room. Once again, people were shouting, hugging each other. They were crying, laughing. Some threw their fists in the air as if they had just scored the winning field goal. Squires, who had been working on those instruments for 8 years, shouted, pounded the desk in front of him, threw both fists into the air, and then dropped to his knees with a palm over his face. Lavery remembered thinking, we did it. God, we did it. People couldn't stop smiling, congratulating each other. One scientist quipped, they told us about the 6 minutes of terror. Why didn't they tell us about the 17 minutes of silence? And not only did it land safely, it was in the best possible position, base down. Now that meant that the panels of the lander could begin to open immediately. And then the rover that was tucked in, whose wings were tucked in, the solar panels, whose arm was tucked in under the body of the rover, who had hunkered down over its wheels, could now unfold in a process that one engineer called reverse robotic origami. When Boykins heard what had happened, he said, I knew we could get pictures that very night, and I began to do my happy dance. He said, all the pomp and circumstance and training went out the window. I was dancing around screaming. People were like, why are you so happy, Kobe? And I'm like, it happened, everything happened. He looked at me and he said, if someone were to write this, they would write it this way. And then he stopped himself and he said, you know, no, not anyone would write it this way. The pictures did come that night, and Eric DeYoung was right. They were amazing. So amazing that the scientists and engineers, when they saw them, began to clap and shout, and some actually, like little children, walked toward them with their fingers out, oohing and aahing. What they pictured was a landscape that could have been a stretch of desert in Arizona or New Mexico, except for the reddish tinge. It was completely flat with rocks that arise off in the distance. That night, Lavery showed me a plaque. He said, there are 12 of these. One's on Spirit. One's on Opportunity. And that's my name. My name's on Mars. And he could have been speaking for everyone. The next morning, the staff, everybody was shaking their heads. They couldn't believe how perfectly it had gone. I caught up to Jennifer Trotsper, now in charge of the Spirit mission. She had been living on Martian time, and so she was exhausted. She hadn't had much sleep, but it didn't dampen her enthusiasm. She said, it's surreal. It's perfect. I prayed for this, but I didn't expect it. We were under such stress. This was NASA's redemption mission for the Mars program. To be under that pressure and to have such a short time to create those rovers, people work so hard. You can see the relief on everyone's faces. There's no way to repay the people except this way. This day makes it all worthwhile. Their joy and celebration continued. On the next day, at a press conference, they had the reporters don 3D glasses, the paper kind from the 1950s. so they could look at a 3D panorama of Mars. It was their turn to ooh and ah, and they did. It was an astonishing, astonishing moment, and no one wanted to let go of it. People talked about the landing of Spirit in terms of birth. A number of people said the flight from Earth to Mars, the 7 months, it was like pregnancy. The excitement and terror of entry, descent, and landing, that was childbirth. And now, our child was born, and it was going off to explore the planet. But 8 days after it began that exploration, all that joy and celebration turned into anxiety. Spirit broke down. It stopped communicating. JPL listed its condition as critical, and it couldn't have come at a worse time. Opportunity was due to land in 2 days. With one rover crippled and the other approaching its own version of the 6 minutes of terror, there was a lot of apprehension at JPL. But Opportunity's landing was beautiful and nowhere near as dramatic as Spirit's. In fact, they never lost touch with the rover as it came down and even as it bounced along the planet. People were so excited. Of course, there was relief and there was joy. Pete Teisinger said we're 2 for 2. And Sean O'Keefe said we're batting 1,000. And Wayne Lee waved the broom in the air. A clean sweep. But the real excitement began when they discovered where they had landed. Squires, again, who had created those scientific instruments and would now lead the scientific mission, said he had hoped that they would land close to a crater so they could examine it. Instead, he announced, we have scored a 300 million mile interplanetary hole in one. We're actually inside an impact crater. Opportunity had landed in a small crater, 60 feet wide, 6 feet deep, and 28 feet away from the first bedrock ever seen on Mars. When the pictures came in, it was a landscape that was completely different than the landscape at Gusev. It was a featureless plain, dark gray, with white outcroppings. Squire said it's beautiful and bizarre and alien. It's unlike anything we've seen before. When the scientists discovered they were 28 feet from bedrock, they got giddy. One said it's like finding the Holy Grail. Squires explained that's because it was the first time they were seeing surface material that hadn't been moved by wind or water or impact. He said these rocks were born in this neighborhood. Now, a week after Spirit broke down, the staff at JPL had discovered the problem and were already fixing it. The rover would work again. It would continue its exploration. And 2 days after that, Opportunity rolled off the lander onto Mars. There were now 12 wheels on Mars. There were now 2 rovers ready to explore the planet. In one way, my story ends there. But of course, in another, it was just beginning. Garvin said, it's like detective fiction now. We have to follow the clues. We are about to embark upon an adventure that we only could have dreamed about. And what an adventure it's been. After Spirit was fixed, it found signs of water in a volcanic rock at Gusev Crater. But it was Opportunity that found the mother lode. On March 23rd, 2004, Squires announced that after studying the rock formations nearby, the scientists thought that Opportunity had landed on the shore of a salty sea. They weren't sure how deep the sea was, but they thought at least 2 inches. Squires thought that maybe it was deep enough to swim in. They weren't sure when it was there or how long, but they were sure of one thing. It could have sustained life. There could have been life on Mars. And now scientists want to find evidence of that life.
Ed Weiler said, if you're interested in finding fossils on the planet's surface, you would begin here. And Garvin is already talking about a mission that would go to Mars and pick up the rocks and bring them back to Earth so they could be studied here. But this adventure isn't over yet. In August of 2004, Spirit found evidence of a deep lake at Gusev Crater. And 11 months after the landings, 8 months longer than officials hoped they would last, the rovers were still going. They've gone over 5 times farther than anyone expected. Move over, Energizer Bunny. The warranty ran out a long time ago, said one official, and things are starting to wear out, but so far the engineers have been able to solve all of the problems. Jim Erickson, mission manager, in December of 2004, said that he thought that both rovers would be around for their anniversaries of their landings. And they were. And they're still going. Carl Sagan, a leading proponent of space exploration, wrote in Pale Blue Dot, "The visions we offer our children shape the future. What those visions are matter. Dreams are maps. Where are the dreams that motivate and inspire? Where are the cartographers of human purpose? Where are the visions of a hopeful future, where technology is a tool for mankind and not a gun on hair trigger pointed at his head? Well, this mission was one of those dreams, one of those visions. Just picture those two little bird-like robotic geologists roaming around on the surface of Mars. It makes you smile. We dreamed we could build them and send them there. And then we did. Who knows what dreams lie ahead?"
I hope you enjoyed listening. This story is distributed under a Creative Commons license, which requires attribution for all reproduction and prohibits commercial use. Find out more about me at my website, sidlieberman.com. That's SYDLIEBERMAN.com.